Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
All right, we need to think about China in this way. They're not just a follower here. They're a serious player who might have some advantages here. They have a very large population, and a very large population is going to produce more of the data needed to train these systems. In the long run, it might produce the talent needed to drive this technology. That's at a premium right now. They're also extremely interested. They've put their stake in the ground, and you see this in certain moments in the book when the Chinese government wakes up to the fact that this is happening. And they say, we're really going to go after it. They have huge ambitions here. And so you do have a lot of concern here in the U.S. about a possible imbalance.
As we mentioned last week, we are taking it easy with a vacation for the entire team this week. So for today's episode, I will be interviewing Cade Metz of the New York Times about his new book, Genius Makers, The Mavericks Who Brought AI to Google, Facebook, and the World. It's a great follow-up to our conversation with Kevin Ruse a few months ago. So lots of good stuff. We hit the usual themes that we at The Realignment are deeply interested in, everything from the future of work to how artificial intelligence will shift everything in our lives and societies, and to the broader context this is all operating in, especially with regards to Silicon Valley and the U.S. military when it comes to competition with China, especially in this newly emerging industry. So a couple of reminders, definitely go check out the Substack. It's linked in the show notes. If you enjoy this interview, go purchase the book at our bookshop. It is linked in the show notes there as well too. And we will also follow up this episode with an episode on Thursday featuring the entire team of The Realignment focused on our recommendations, everything from our favorite episode of the show to a book recommendation or two, and of course, podcasts that aren't ours that you all should go check out. Lots of good stuff, but hope you all enjoyed this interview. Huge thank you to Lincoln Network. Let's dive in. Cade Metz, welcome to The Realignment.
Glad to be here.
So we're here to talk about your book, Genius Makers, The Mavericks Who Brought AI to Google, Facebook, and the World. Let's start here. What actually is artificial intelligence? Something we spoke with your colleague Kevin Ruse about is the fact that the terms robot, AI, supercomputer are often mixed up so much that it's hard to have a strong picture of what we're actually discussing here. So let's just define your conception and the people who you profile's conception in the book of what AI actually is.
It's a great question, and I think it's always worth starting with that question. It is a term that gets applied to everything nowadays, in news stories, in television news broadcasts, and so people don't have a good idea of what it is. And that's because it's an old term that dates back to the 50s that even then, applied to any technology that was vaguely built in an effort to duplicate what the human brain can do. We've never really achieved that. But what I find is helpful is to think about individual pieces of technology that are gaining steam. Mm-hmm. What my book is really about is about a single technological idea that was first thought of in the 40s and the 50s, but has recently started to work and is really changing so many of the technologies we use on a daily basis. And that's an idea called a neural network. And we can talk about specifically what that is, but it's an idea that is driving Siri's ability to recognize the commands you speak into your iPhone. It drives facial recognition technologies on a social media service like Facebook, but also the services that police departments are using. It helps driverless cars see the world around them. The list goes on. Chatbots, technologies that can carry on a conversation, which are getting better and better, they use this one idea. And so I think it's helpful to talk about this one idea which has started to work amidst all these other technologies that we have and have long had and that are also improving. But really, when it comes to AI gaining steam over the last decade, it's this one idea that has done it.
So before we dive into that, let's start here. What just are those other technologies that we should bracket off to the side so people have a good mental picture of this?
Yeah, well, there are all sorts of algorithms that can automate things. You know, you have an algorithm on, say, YouTube, which helps choose the videos that are going to be suggested to you. You have algorithms in the Facebook news feed that are just going to suggest and decide what you see. We have algorithms in the justice system that help decide, you know, who gets bail and who not. These are all technologies that play a role in our daily lives. People like to call them AI, but they're pretty simple technologies at this point. They don't work like the human brain does. They don't deal with kind of the chaos and the uncertainty in the world with the nuance that our brain does. They're very simple. What we're seeing, though, is in certain areas, and this is what I think we should go into, we're developing systems that can operate in a much more powerful way and that can really learn their skills on their own. That's getting closer to the way we humans work. We learn from our environment, and then we apply what we learn. And that's what a neural network is able to do. It's able to learn from vast amounts of digital data to carry out a particular task. And that's when things get complicated. That's when we don't quite understand how the machine is operating. We don't quite understand what it has learned.
So you said something that we should get into, which is this is something that really started the 40s, 50s. There's an AI winter in the 70s. And then you're making the point that it's really in the past decade that this is all sped up. So can you just articulate why, from the way we think about technology usually, this has taken so quote unquote long? This isn't like cryptocurrency or even our modern conception of the internet, where it feels like the idea is there and then it goes and then it just sort of moves in the popular imagination. Why has this field taken so long to develop?
So in order to explain that, let's talk about very simply what a neural network is. A neural network is a mathematical system that can, like I said, learn a skill by analyzing data. So the example I always give is you feed thousands of cat photos into a neural network. It can analyze those photos and look for patterns that identify what a cat looks like. That's how that system literally learns to recognize a cat. And that basic mathematical idea dates back to the 40s and the 50s, like I said. But back then, we didn't have the amount of data that was needed to make that work. You need, like I said, thousands of cat photos to make that work. And you also need the processing power, the computer processing power, to do that analysis. We didn't have that either. So this idea worked in tiny ways back in the late 50s and 60s, but was flawed. And people didn't realize how much data and how much processing power we would need. And so most of them quit working on the idea. A few people kept working, however. And then by about 2010, we had those ingredients. We had the data, we had the processing power, and that's when it worked. Suddenly we had systems that could learn by analyzing spoken words to recognize those spoken words, that could analyze those photos of a cat and learn to recognize a cat. And that's the big inflection point around 2010.
Speaking of inflection points, when it comes to books on this space, a lot of them either are optimistic, very pessimistic. This is a reported book, so it's not quite as if you have a thesis here, quote unquote. But when we're looking back at that 40s and 50s period, I'm guessing there's a lot of optimism about the technology behind neural networks. Right now, we're in in the popular culture, a pessimistic phase. How would you characterize, let's pretend you're just reading your book neutrally. Would someone read your book, engage with the figures who you profile, of a company, the technology? Do you think they would be optimistic, pessimistic, or neutral?
It's funny. some people read it and get one thing out of it. Others read it and get another. And I think what that reflects is how complicated these situations are. And what you see, even in the past, is a lot of the same things we're dealing with now. These things tend to go in cycles of optimism and pessimism, hope for the technology versus, you know, questioning whether or not it's ever going to work. There's this great moment in the book in the late 50s when a guy named Frank Rosenblatt, who really built the first practical neural network, all it could do was analyze cards with giant printed letters, so a giant letter A or a giant letter B, and it could learn to recognize those printed letters. Then in the pages of my own paper, the New York Times, he made these extravagant claims about where this was going to go. It was not going to just recognize printed letters. It was going to recognize photos. It was going to recognize speech, learn to talk on its own, actually build itself on an assembly line, and then somehow fly into space and who knows what, right? And this is the way this often happens. You get a little bit of progress, and then people say it's going to go much, much further. And then that's when you get those AI winners, when a few years pass and people realize that the technology isn't up to all those extravagant claims. And then companies and governments start to pull the funding, and then the technology doesn't advance even at the pace it was before. But then you get the cycle reinventing itself, right? People forget about the flaws. They forget about the problems. The money goes back into it. And then you get the cycle all over again. We're in the middle of one of those. And what I think is instructive is to look back on the past and see the limitations and see the concerns, the flaws in these systems, the problems they can bring. Over the past decade, this technology has brought some serious problems. And it's still not at the point where it has reached the power of the human brain that so many people promise. What happens when it's even more powerful?
What do you mean problems? Just to clarify, what problems?
Well, we could spend the whole podcast talking about that, right? So you have these systems start to work around 2010 for speech recognition, image recognition, natural language understanding. I talk about chatbots. So these systems now can analyze vast amounts of digital text, Wikipedia articles, books, other content from the internet, and they can learn the vagaries of the English language, say. And then you can apply that to specific tasks like a chatbot, a system that can carry on a conversation, or the Google search engine. This now helps the Google search engine understand what you're asking for. And those are all great things, particularly if you're a company like Google or Facebook. But what we didn't see initially is that these systems that learn from data also learn our flaws. They learn our biases. If you're learning from text on the internet, you're learning bias. Anyone who's used the internet knows the internet is biased. You know it's full of hate speech. All that gets wrapped up into these systems. That's an issue. These systems learn things that we don't necessarily expect because they're learning from so much more data than we as humans could ever wrap our heads around. But that's just one problem. The other thing with these systems is if you can recognize a cat, that means you can also create an image of a cat, right? Mm-hmm. You flip these systems upside down, they become systems of creation. They can create images, create sounds, create text. That means they can create disinformation. And again, anyone who's lived over the past 4 years knows the problem of disinformation online. That's mostly driven by people nowadays. You put a bunch of people in a room and you have them create fake images or fake sounds, fake videos, fake articles. It happens on a relatively small scale. What happens when the machines can do that as well as a human, but on a much greater scale than humans ever could? Then we have a serious disinformation problem. Go ahead. I mean, I could go on.
I mean, that's like you said, that's there's a version where that's the whole podcast. But I want to go back to something because something we're really interested on something we're interested in going into on this show is the relationship between government and innovation. And something you pointed out is that it's not as if this has been a profit-generating industry ever. So government and funding and choices around have been a huge part of it. And to your point, if it's the 60s and 70s and all of the promise that you could see from these technologies didn't pan out, you're not going to see a lot of investment activity or interest there. So you see the period of the winter and you see funding pulling back. What are the implications of this reality? Because I actually just want to pull up a quote from James Fallows. He did a good review of the book in the Times, where he just pointed out that people overestimate what technology can do in a year, and then they underestimate what it can do in a decade and beyond. So can you just talk about what both your writing and then even James's quote, what this means for funding investment? Because the key thing is that, you know, in the book, and we'll get into who exactly you're profiling, we're talking about companies today. So it's not as if this is purely just, you know, government people at the Pentagon or some lab. It's really the market and a mix of things. So can you just talk about this dynamic?
Yes, that is the new dynamic. You've pinpointed it. What happened is that when this technology started to work around 2010, it's the big internet companies that got interested. And we're talking about not only Google, Microsoft, Facebook, you know, American-based companies, but companies overseas as well, Chinese companies. It's the companies with the data and with the processing power that see the power of this first and really jump on it. It can really help drive their bottom line. With Google, you know, it sees the technology, immediately put it onto Android phones as a way of recognizing the spoken word. That's a way of driving their bottom line. They paid enormous amounts of money for the few people who were specialists in this area, and they've continued to invest. The technology continues to develop at a surprising rate, even for people who worked on it for decades, and it's helping to drive these companies. And so the dynamic has shifted. You're right. In the past, it was government labs, mostly military labs, investing in this, in academia and the like. Now you've got this weird imbalance where all the talent and the other currencies you need to build this stuff, the data and the processing power, are not in government. They're in these large public companies. And we might think of Google as an American company, but really it's an international company. And its needs and wants aren't necessarily aligned with the U.S. government. And that's another area where we've seen a clash. It's a fascinating thing to think about, but it also has huge implications for the future. When you think about the U.S., say, and how it competes with the rest of the world, it's a brand new landscape.
Yeah, and you've written about this in your reporting at the Times. There's obviously, over the course of the past several years, really concerted employee revolts over everything from working with ICE and border security to actually working for the military. So I'm thinking of, and I'm probably going to miss one, but so for example, this happened at Google, controversy at Amazon in certain respects, controversy at Microsoft. Going back to the Cold War era, where these military technologies were a different source. So we're thinking of, you know, Raytheon and fighter planes and just very 20th century great power conflict type things. Those were private companies that were producing the technologies and the government was either funding or supporting them. What does that relationship look like today?
Right. So it has shifted. If you think about Raytheon and companies like that, they were built to work with the U.S. Department of Defense, right?
The business model inherently is tied.
Inherently, they're designed to do that. So if you go to work for Raytheon, you know you're working with the military, period. Now you have this new situation where companies like Google, which are consumer internet companies, in part, are working with the military. And that was a surprise to a lot of people who were even working at the companies. And the prime example here is called Project Maven and Google's role in that. Project Maven was an effort and still is an effort by the US military to identify objects in drone footage. So it uses the same technology we've been talking about, a neural network. And Google went to work with the military, with the DOD on this project. And it really upset a lot of people at the company who didn't think that this technology in particular should be used in this way. It's a path towards autonomous weapons, right? If you can identify objects in drone footage, that can be a way of identifying targets. And if you put a weapon on your drone, you've built an autonomous weapon. And that has really concerned a lot of people who spent decades building this technology. They didn't want their technology used in this way. Suddenly, Google, who some of these people started working for, was doing that very thing. And there was
it? Do no evil, Google. It's not the original catchphrase again?
It's true. But I think it's more pointed than that. Like the central character in my book is a guy named Jeff Hinton. And he's someone who spent decades working on this idea, the idea of a neural network. In the 80s, when he found, along with some others, a missing mathematical piece to this technology, and it really started to take off in a way in the 80s, he was at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh. And he realized the only way to keep doing this research was to take money from Ronald Reagan's Defense Department. He did not want to do that. He did not want his technology used for military purposes. And he actually left the country. He went to Canada. He and his wife went to Canada. And so the center of gravity for this idea of a neural network moved to Canada. And that's where it was in 2010 when this idea finally started to work. And Jeff, as you learn in the opening of my book, you know, is sucked into industry. He moves into Google, and that's a great story we can go into because it gets at a lot of these issues we're talking about. But he moves into Google, and then pretty soon Google is using his technology in this way with the military, right? You have really idealistic people who built these technologies, and then suddenly their ideals are clashing with these giant internet companies again.
Can you just, from a reporter's perspective, explain why this phenomenon is happening? Because since, I'll use a cliche, since time immemorial, technology and warfare and science and the type of people who become scientists have been inherently tied together. You know, Alfred Nobel gets his money by developing TNT, everything like that. So there's a intractable link there. Why in this moment specifically, even going back to the 80s then, are we seeing this specific conflict happening?
Well, in part, it was because this was a technology that no one really believed in. There was this tiny group of people who believed in this one idea. They were not in the US and they were in academia. They were career academics and they brought an academic sensibility to this. And then it was immediate when they moved into industry. That's a very different environment. So there wasn't a big runway there. It was people from a different world moving into industry. And in some ways, they did change the way industry worked. And we can talk about that in positive ways. But also, they ran into some issues that maybe they didn't even expect. Certainly, many of them didn't expect. And so that is new. You've always had people from academia moving into industry and vice versa. You've had all sorts of ways of funding research, but you had a very sudden change. That's what we're still struggling to deal with, I think.
That's a really fascinating and useful way to put it. There's another obvious player that we should talk about. And you also did a great piece on this that we'll link in the show notes. OpenAI, obviously co-founded by Elon Musk, led by Sam Altman, who's a huge figure in Silicon Valley. OpenAI also developed GPT-3, not great with acronyms. Can you explain what this is, why it matters, and how like that's their unique entry into the space?
GPT-3 is a fascinating thing, and that's the type of natural language technology I was talking about. So think of GPT-3 as a giant neural network, and you feed it thousands of books, thousands of Wikipedia articles, all sorts of other content from the internet, And it spends months, literally months, analyzing all that English text, looking for patterns in that text that really show the way you and I and other humans piece English together and use it. In learning how to piece English together, that system becomes far more powerful than even some of its creators thought it would be. Once it learns all that, you can apply it to all sorts of tasks, including, say, conversation. So once it's learned from all that data, you can feed it just a few more examples of something, like a conversation, just like a turn-by-turn conversation, and it learns to mimic that just from a few more examples. Mm-hmm. You can feed it a couple of computer programs, and it can learn to write its own computer program. You can feed it some tweets, and it learns to write its own tweets. The list of possibilities is almost endless. And what you're seeing is that this can be applied in the real world today. Google helps this drive its search engine. The search engine, which is basically a Q&A system, right? You ask a question, it gives you an answer. It uses this type of technology to better understand what you're looking for and give you a better answer. But the progress in the future, many people think, will continue to accelerate, and we'll see this drive all sorts of more powerful technologies. Again, it's something that people didn't expect. Even the people working on neural networks didn't think it would get here this quickly.
Yeah, you had a there's a good quote in the piece that you wrote on the technology where you pointed out that all the designers had really taught it to do, quote unquote, is predict the next text that was going to come. So it wasn't as if they predicted that people were going to be able to use this to write new computer programs or accelerate these ways. This is a good point to bring up another quote from James Fowles's piece, which is just pointing out that technology obviously shapes the nature and society of our society in ways that we wouldn't just conventionally think about. So for example, sprawling suburbs are a result of the automobile. Subway systems, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Not going to ask you to make predictions because that's never perfectly useful and no one really enjoys doing that. But based on the folks who you're profiling, you're in their heads to a certain degree. How do you think they predict these technologies could shape the future of American society for good or for ill?
Well, I think what is so interesting is that they all have such different views. We tend to think about Silicon Valley as this monolithic entity and that everyone agrees, or we tend to think about the AI community, the community of researchers, as this monolithic thing. The reality is that you have all sorts of different people in this area who view the technology completely differently. OpenAI is extremely ambitious, and they see this as a path to what they call AGI, artificial general intelligence, a system that can do anything the human brain can do. And they think this is going to come relatively quickly. And they see it as a really positive thing. It will change the economy. It will allow people to work less. And this will be a positive thing. And they're already thinking about how to distribute wealth and the like. Other people who are just as close to technology think that that notion is ridiculous and that we're nowhere close to such a system. In similar ways, people think about the ills that this technology can bring in different ways. Some people are really frightened by the prospect of these systems spreading disinformation. Other people don't think it's an issue, or they're less concerned about it than others are. You really see this technology reflecting the personalities in some ways, or the view of the technology reflecting the personalities of the researchers and the people who are building it. You get a very different attitude in Silicon Valley where OpenAI is versus if you go back to Canada and you go back to the academic community and some of the companies that have sprung up are around the universities there. They're going to take a very different view. It's amazing how people kind of see themselves in the technology in a way.
You know, it's funny. I And I promise this is the final James Fallows quote we'll bring into the article, but you keep teeing me up. He pointed out that, at least in his estimation, we as a society have perpetually overestimated the freedom and the lack of work that we'll have to do because of new technology. So I think of this in the context of COVID. I mean, how many op-eds were there about how work from home was going to free us and be really great and there's no more commute? But I personally am doing way more work than I was. All the time that I spent commuting has been poured into actually doing work. And now I actually have a bunch of friends. We'll just like walk around randomly to do a morning commute. So what do you think about this idea of technologies freeing us to do other things? In terms of the predictions people have made about whether or not that's a thing or not?
Generally speaking, I'm just talking in broad strokes here. Too much has been made of that, right? The reality is that even with something like GPT-3, which is so amazing, which we talked about, it works in these unexpected ways. It's also very flawed. One example I often give is that when I was writing that piece for The Times about it, one of my editors said, why don't you ask it to give us a speech in the voice of Donald Trump? And 5 times out of 10, it gave me an unbelievable speech. Sounded like Trump, used, you know, phrases and humor that he would use. It was jaw-dropping. The other 5 times, it didn't quite work. Mm-hmm. And that's how you need to think about a lot of these technologies. They're working really well in some ways, but they're not perfect. And they're not certainly as good as humans when it comes to repeating themselves in some cases, or dealing with all the uncertainty and the chaos in the world. Another good example is a self-driving car. Mm-hmm. These things work well enough to drive around a city in a careful demonstration. But when it comes to putting them out into the world and just letting them go on their own, that's a different prospect. You still need humans to do so many tasks. And whereas GPT-3 is going to change the way so many technologies work and remove some of the burden from us in some ways, we are still needed. And that's true of most of the ways this technology is really starting to work and really starting to move into the real world. It's something that's used alongside humans, not necessarily replacing what we do. So it's going to replace part of what we do, but then you're right, we move into other areas. And we, although that we might be relieved of duties in some ways, there are new duties we're always going to find.
Yeah, that's great. So, I mean, and just to use your Donald Trump example, I think the key thing here to conceptualize this is that it's still better just to hire a speechwriter than use this. It's better for them to have speechwriters at the White House or at the campaign when it's a 50% hit rate. That's just not actually particularly useful. It's novel, it's cool, but it's a cute feature. It's not actually something that would transform the speechwriting industry if the speechwriters who listen are concerned about that. So for this last section, I want to take this into the global context because there's been a lot of really interesting things that have happened on this lately. So first, we would start with the European Union. So the EU has actually started talking about regulating artificial intelligence. It'd be really useful for you to just give some context on what that's looking like. But then second, on a more meta level, can you just discuss what that even looks like? Because I don't think anyone really conceives of the EU as this strong, powerful institution that can truly shape the natures of these industries within countries. And I don't see a world where France or Germany truly are developing things, but they're going to somehow decide not to do things because of a broader body. So can you just speak about the EU and what they're doing?
Yeah, it's worth piecing this apart. First of all, you're right. We're not sure where this is going to go. We're not sure what the EU's role in the larger landscape is going to be. We've sort of seen a preview of this with their efforts to control privacy online. Some would argue it hasn't worked as well as maybe some in the EU hoped. But they are looking at a lot of the important issues. They're thinking about that disinformation problem that I talked about and the prevalence of what we call deepfakes in the future and that sort of disinformation that can be easily spread. They want to try to force companies, say, to label deepfakes and the like. Now, that's easier said than done, but it's something that we as a society need to think about. Globally, these are technologies that are spreading across the globe. It's not limited to a particular part of the world. And it makes sense for all of us in the EU, in the US, in China, to think about these issues. And how one country or continent is going to deal with things is going to affect how others think about it. Another issue they're looking at is face recognition, when this should be used and when not. Should it be used in public spaces? Should it be used by the police? And in what context should it be used? There are so many of these issues to think about, and the EU is trying to tackle them. Now, the problem is, among many, that this technology is improving at an incredible rate. And these rules that the EU wants to put in place are going to take years. Mm-hmm. Is the technology going to be at a completely different spot? That's part of the problem here. But again, if the EU bans some of these things, what's going to happen in the rest of the world? A good example there is autonomous weapons. If autonomous weapons are banned here in the US, that just means our rivals are going to adopt the technology and we'll be at a disadvantage. That's something that if you're going to ban it, if you're going to control it, you've got to do it on a global scale.
Yeah, I mean, you have a game theory problem where there's an incentive. There's a clear incentive. Oh, if the EU is doing this, let's seize the opportunity there. Because as we've been discussing, there's this weird mix of market opportunity. So, and I want to get to China in a second, but something I was just thinking about during your point about Google and Microsoft and the conflicts over the military, that's created a market opportunity for other companies to come in. So Anduril, for example, is very much saying, hey, like, we're not in Silicon Valley, Bay Area proper. We're in Orange County. We want to work with the military, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So when there's a marketplace that's currently operating here and different players and different incentives, it's difficult to balance that. But for our last bit here, let's just talk about the real elephant in the room that shapes basically every one of these types of conversation, which is like US-China competition. Before we started this recording, we were talking about how at the start of the book, there's one of the scientists you profile, he's debating whether or not he wants to sell his company, his idea to an American company or to a Chinese company. And I was just thinking, man, that is not a conversation that is going as cavalierly as was occurring back during the 2000s. So it'd just be great for you to bring in the Chinese context to this.
Absolutely. You're right. The book opens with Jeff Hinton, who I mentioned earlier, realizing his technology is starting to work and literally auctioning his services off to the highest bidder. He's in Lake Tahoe at the time, and you've got Google bidding for his services and Microsoft, a tiny lab in London called DeepMind, which would rise to the fore over the next decade, is also bidding. And then the fourth player, which most people did not realize at the time, and actually didn't realize until the book came out, was Baidu, who's often called the Google of China. It's one of the largest internet companies in the world. It saw where this technology was going and was on it from the beginning, alongside the Googles and the Microsofts. It's not as if China is just following here. China was there from the beginning. And it's instructive, right? We need to think about China in this way. They're not just a follower here. They're a serious player who might have some advantages here. They have a very large population, and a very large population is going to produce more of the data needed to train these systems. In the long run, it might produce the talent needed to drive this technology. That's at a premium right now. They're also extremely interested. Now, they've put their stake in the ground, and you see this in certain moments in the book when the Chinese government wakes up to the fact that this is happening, and they say, we're really going to go after it. They have huge ambitions here. And so you do have a lot of concern here in the US about a possible imbalance. Now, the situation is more complex than people might realize. It's not like the Cold War of the 50s, where things are a bit more cut and dry. The dynamics, and we alluded to this earlier, are far more complicated in this world.
Yeah. And what, something I'm trying to get a better understanding of is, what is the US government's quote unquote response then? Because this is, and this is the key thing which you just got at with this comment, which is, right now, this isn't an existential conflict, right? This isn't, obviously the space race turned into more of a sideshow towards the end, but the initial fear is, if it's Sputnik, man, they could place satellites above us and drop nuclear weapons on us. So obviously you're going to see an aggressive US response to support STEM, go into space, catch up, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If you're sitting in the White House or the DOD right now, how are you thinking about the competition, quote unquote?
Well, Eric Schmidt, the former CEO of Google, recently put together, alongside a commission of other people, a report for Congress and the president that tries to deal with these issues. A lot of what they're trying to do is solve this imbalance between industry and government here in the US. In China, industry and government work hand in hand. In the US, you've got something very different, where all the talent and the technology is in these private companies and not in the government. And so their main objective is to solve that problem, find a better way to educate people to work on this stuff in the government. So they want to shift the funding. See, we get more funding into government labs, academic labs, universities in general. They're even thinking about, and this is a fascinating idea, a West Point for digital services. So think of it as like a West Point for AI researchers. You would have this national academy that would help train people. But also what they want to do is make it easier for industry and government to work together. And you know, this gets back to the problem with Google and Project Maven. Google, because of the protests inside the company, ended up pulling out of that project. The government knows it needs the Googles of the world to advance this. So they're working to kind of grease the wheels between these large public companies or small ones like Anduril. You mentioned Anduril, who's working on autonomous drones, trying to find better ways of working with this type of technology company.
Do you think in today's, because obviously if we're looking at trends that COVID accelerated, another terrible cliche, but we'll roll with it, US-China context changing, the conversation is way different than it was in 2017. Do you think the debate within Google would go the same direction that it went if this happened today?
It's a great question. It may not. What you're seeing is Google shift in many ways when it comes to these types of technologies that have raised issues within its workforce in the past. So after Google pulled out of Project Maven, a lot of the people who were involved in the protests were forced out of the company. You're seeing other situations where company protests were put down in a sense, and employees doing the protesting were forced out. Google has made it clear that they do want to work with the military, and they will continue to do so. So I think you're right. We're seeing a shift in the way things are working.
And my last question, and I'm wondering, and this could be too much of a meta thing, but how much does the competition aspect play into this? So for example, obviously you have Peter Thiel, who's entwined with these things a lot, accusing Google of being infested by Chinese spies. You see Anduril very much positioning itself as a more patriotic company. You have Mark Zuckerberg, who's getting into his own conflicts of other tech companies, saying that, you know, Facebook is an American company in the same way that Chinese companies are Chinese companies. How much is that playing into the mindset of executives at these companies?
Well, it's playing into it in a huge way. I think that Peter Thiel example is particularly illustrative, right? Peter Thiel is talking about the researchers who worked with Google on Project Maven. A lot of those researchers were Chinese nationals. Now, that wasn't a classified project. From Google's perspective, there was no problem. And the DOD's perspective, by the way, there was no problem with those Chinese nationals working on that project. But Peter Thiel used that as a way to promote his own efforts. Anduril, Palantir, and these other companies that are built to work with the government, that's absolutely a part of it. The other thing that shows, the fact that there were Chinese nationals working for Google on this DoD project, it shows how important immigrant talent is to the U.S. It's been like that for a long time. It's particularly important now. All these people we've been talking about who worked on this idea of a neural network over the decades, most of them were not in the U.S. As I point out, they were in Canada. They were in Europe. They were in France and the U.K. A lot of them were born outside the borders of the U.S. and became very important to U.S. efforts. We can't just think about shutting down our borders to immigrant talent. It can really hurt us.
I think that's a great place to leave things. Cade, thank you so much. It's been really helpful. Everyone, definitely go check out the book. But anything else you want to quickly shout out? Any recent reporting, anything like that?
No, I enjoyed the conversation, and thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming. You guys liked the show. Just to run down a few things. One, we'll be back on Thursday with a special edition of the show focused on recommendations with everyone on Team Realignment, our production assistants, James and Emma, Phil, our producer, and of course, me and Sagar. So lots of good stuff there. Be sure to tune in, check out our Substack, and send in any questions you would like answered on the show once we are fully back next week. See you then.